I get letters from people saying that in their own church, they cannot even raise these questions. And the fact that there are a number of people who are standing up and saying we really need to address the issues of justice with respect to homosexual people is a torch of hope for people who live in much more repressive cultures.
We really wanted to make this movie because she had always been portrayed so one-sided as a monster.
It's not what you think it is, all right?
I know what it is.
No, you don't know my life, Selby.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Queer UN workers' partners benefit from inclusion. Vancouver's Bishop Ingham leads on where other Anglicans fear to tread. And capturing a killer's contradictions creates an award-winning monster. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending January 31st, 2004. The United Nations announced this week that it will extend family benefits to its gay and lesbian employees whose relationships are legally recognized in their home countries. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan first stated the policy in an internal bulletin last week, and it will go into effect February 1st. He wrote that it would continue to ensure respect for the social, religious, and cultural diversity of the member states and of their nationals. The UN is checking with national delegations as to whether their workers should receive the benefits. Only about a dozen of the 191 member nations are expected to agree. The U.S. will not be one of them, despite some states' recognition of gay and lesbian couples. Any references to gays and lesbians in UN proposals to date have fallen to powerful opposition led by the Vatican and predominantly Muslim nations. Debate will be renewed in March or April as the 53-nation UN Human Rights Commission meeting in Geneva considers taking a stand against human rights violations based on sexual orientation.
Protection for the human rights of lesbian, gays, and transgenders is advancing in the Philippines as the National House of Representatives approved an anti-discrimination bill last week. The bill would prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity in areas including education, health services, public accommodations, and employment by private businesses, government, and the military. It would also punish harassment by the military or police. Although similar measures have been introduced since 1998, this is the first time one has won passage on the floor of either house. HB 6416 was drafted in conjunction with Lagablag Pilipinas, the Lesbian and Gay Legislative Advocacy Network Philippines, and introduced by Akbayan Party Representative Loretta Ann Rosales. The bill has been sent to a committee of the Senate, where gays and lesbians are now actively lobbying for it.
The Philippine Civil Rights Bill has already advanced farther than any similar federal measure in the U.S. over three decades, and equal treatment of gays and lesbians took a heavy blow in two courts there this week. Kansas State Court of Appeals upheld much harsher sentencing for homosexual acts between teenagers than for heterosexual acts. When the U.S. Supreme Court issued its landmark June decision in Lawrence v. Texas that struck down state sodomy laws, it also vacated the Kansas conviction of Matt Limon and instructed the state appellate court to review the case in light of the ruling. 4 years ago, at age 18, Limon had sex with a 14-year-old male. Both were residents at a group home for people with developmental disabilities. In Kansas, all sex acts involving anyone under age 16 are illegal. For consensual heterosexual acts where the older partner is under age 19 and is no more than 4 years older than a 14 to 16-year-old partner, a so-called Romeo and Juliet provision applies that caps sentences at 15 months. But that provision explicitly applies only to a couple who are members of the opposite sex, and because Limon's partner was male, he was sentenced to more than 17 years in prison.
Representing Limon, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, argued that the Lawrence decision implied a requirement for equal sentencing. But two of the three state appellate judges interpreted the high court ruling narrowly, finding it did not apply to laws on sex acts with children. They found the state law's discrimination to be justifiable on grounds including greater health risks and, in the words of the ruling, to prevent the gradual deterioration of the sexual morality approved by a majority of Kansans, it would encourage and preserve the traditional sexual mores of society. The majority believed that freeing males who had sex with teenaged girls would encourage them to marry those girls and to support any children they had fathered, while there would be no such reason to keep a homosexual partner out of prison. The ACLU will appeal to the Kansas State Supreme Court and, if necessary, to the U.S. Supreme Court. Lamone's attorney, Tamara Lang, said the nation's highest court made it very clear that traditional sexual mores are no longer a legitimate rationale for discriminating against gay and lesbian people. Dissenting Kansas judge Joseph Pierin Jr. agreed, writing, "This blatantly discriminatory sentencing provision does not live up to American standards of equal justice." State Attorney General Phil Klein believes the ruling will also serve to support Kansas's law denying legal marriage to same-gender couples.
Also upheld in the face of an ACLU challenge this week was Florida's explicit ban on adoptions by gays, lesbians, and bisexuals, currently the only such state law in the nation to apply whether they're single or partnered. This decision could be more widely damaging than the Kansas ruling because it comes from a federal appellate court, a unanimous finding by a 3-judge panel of the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. They wrote, "We exercise great caution when asked to take sides in an ongoing public policy debate, such as the current one over the compatibility of homosexual conduct with the duties of adoptive parenthood. The state of Florida has made the determination that it is not in the best interests of its displaced children to be adopted by individuals who, in the words of the state law, engage in current voluntary homosexual activity, and we have found nothing in the Constitution that forbids this policy judgment. The legislature is the proper forum for this debate, and we do not sit as a super legislature."
The state's rationale, echoed by its governor and the U.S. president's brother, Jeb Bush, as well as a trial court's earlier ruling in this case, is that it's in the best interests of children to live with a heterosexual couple. Yet more than 3,000 children remain in foster care in Florida. Gays and lesbians, both single and partnered, are among those providing foster care there. In fact, the parties in the test case are gay men seeking to adopt children they've long fostered. A few Florida judges have even made some same-gender couples permanent legal guardians of children. To the ACLU, these facts discredit the ostensible child welfare motive for the ban, leaving only prejudice to justify it. The ACLU will appeal the ruling, although it has not yet determined whether to seek a rehearing by the full bench of the 11th Circuit or consideration by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Adoption issues are quite different in gay-friendly European nations where relatively few children are wards of the state. Agence France-Presse noted this week that it's been a year since Sweden gave its registered gay and lesbian partners the same status as married couples to adopt unrelated children together. But most adoptions in Sweden are of foreign children, primarily from China, Colombia, and South Korea. Sweden's 6 adoption agencies working with foreign countries have yet to win any nation's agreement to send children to gay and lesbian couples there. On the other hand, and possibly as a result, so far only a few same-gender Swedish couples have applied for an international adoption.
Belgium, the second nation in the world to open legal marriage to same-gender couples, will make those marriages available to more of those couples on February 6th, Expatica.com reports. Until then, Belgian marriages can be performed only between European couples who could legally marry in their home countries, which has effectively restricted gay and lesbian marriages to citizens of Belgium and the Netherlands. But that requirement is about to end, opening Belgian marriages to any same-gender couple of which one or both members at least visits Belgium often, regardless of their home country's views on the matter.
And although some 2,500 gay and lesbian couples have already been married in 2 provinces of Canada, the wait for a federal marriage equality law there just got significantly longer. While new Prime Minister Paul Martin made his clearest statement yet that his government stands behind legalizing same-gender marriage, that same government added a further question to the marriage review his predecessor sought from the Supreme Court of Canada. In order to prepare the additional arguments, Justice Minister Erwin Kotler is also asking the High Court to delay its hearing on the issue, currently scheduled for April. The upshot is that there's not likely to be a vote in the Parliament until late 2005. Martin denied the move was a delaying tactic, saying the question to the court was important for the parliamentary debate. The government is asking the court whether the one-man-one-woman definition of marriage could be retained without violating the National Charter of Rights and Freedoms, since many would prefer to extend equal status under a different name, such as civil union. Although the Supreme Court's opinion on the question would not be legally binding, the top provincial courts in Ontario and British Columbia have already found that only equal marriage rights are constitutionally sound. This week, the Quebec Court of Appeal heard arguments in a similar lawsuit for marriage equality, although that province already offers gay and lesbian civil unions.
And finally, U.S. TV cablecaster Showtime hoped its new lesbian drama, The L Word, would match the success of its Queer as Folk. Those dreams came true, as the first two editions drew four times the channel's average primetime audience. Showtime responded by giving L Word the fastest renewal in its history, contracting for a second batch of 13 episodes just 11 days after the series premiere.
That's News Wrap for the week ending January 31st, 2004. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
The gruesomeness of the story is matched by the power of the performances in an Oscar-worthy movie. Hear some riveting clips and meet the filmmaker and her stars later in the program. Bishop Michael Ingham of Vancouver, British Columbia's Diocese of New Westminster has been a leading figure in the movement to make lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people an equal part of the Anglican Communion. Since he approved the right of willing congregations to bless same-gender unions in 2002, eight parishes have broken away from the diocese, and ecclesiastical charges have been laid against seven of their ministers. As a committee of the House of Bishops works to resolve the conflict, Ingham's position remains steadfast. He talked about the source of his conviction in part one of his conversation with This Way Out's Heather Kitching.
I want gay and lesbian and transgendered people to know that they are welcome in the Anglican Church. The overwhelming witness of Scripture is that God loves all people unconditionally.
In this week's conclusion, Bishop Ingham discusses the controversy and the support and the consecration of openly gay-partnered New Hampshire Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson.
Can you tell me about the process that led up to deciding to lay ecclesiastical charges against seven of the ministers of the churches that broke away? I mean, it seems like a very extreme measure.
What we've said in our church here is that we want to create a space for everybody. We're not imposing anything on anybody against their conscience, but we can't really continue to have people cross the line from legitimate dissent, which is okay, to destructive behavior, which is not okay. And the charges that were laid had to do with allegations of behavior that were injurious to the church. So I know it seems to some people like a kind of repressive measure, but it really wasn't. It was an attempt to preserve the structures of the church that are, in fact, the best guarantee of safety for the disaffected people themselves.
So we've heard a lot about this controversy in the media, largely from people who oppose the church's decision. Would you say that the opposition has been overreported, or that the support has been underreported?
I think disaffection and anger always gets more attention from media. We monitor all the letters and phone calls and emails that come into this office, and by a large majority, the support outweighs the criticism. I was in San Francisco a month ago and preaching in the cathedral, Grace Cathedral there, and 1,000 people rose to their feet and applauded the Diocese of New Westminster. And the bishop spoke to them, their own bishop spoke to them, and asked me to bring back to Vancouver the entire support of people in his diocese in California. And I get that, you know, all the time. I get letters from Africa, Asia, Australia, North and South America, people saying that in their own church they cannot even raise these questions. They're repressed, forbidden to speak. And the fact that now in the United States and Canada, there are a number of people who are standing up and saying we really need to address the issues of justice, compassion with respect to homosexual people is a torch of hope for people who live in much more repressive cultures.
Can you tell me, you went to the consecration of Bishop Gene Robinson in the States. What prompted you to decide to attend that? And can you tell me a bit about what that was like for you?
Well, Gene Robinson invited me to go, and I happened to be in Toronto at meetings the same weekend, or my meetings had just ended, so it was not difficult to go down. And I wanted to be part of an historic moment in the life of the church. I was glad I was there. What shocked me, frankly, was when I met Gene Robinson for the first time, and I don't know him personally other than that one meeting, was to find him wearing a bulletproof vest. He was wearing a Kevlar jacket all around his torso, and he wore that underneath his ecclesiastical robes all through the service. And that brought home to me in a really, really vivid way the danger in which gay and lesbian people still exist within the Christian church. But I found him to be a man of great warmth, great wisdom, great patience. And there was such joy among the people of New Hampshire. And it's a fairly conservative place. I mean, we're not talking about sort of a radical culture in New Hampshire. There was such evident joy among the people that they'd found a bishop that loved them and that they loved, that it made all of the controversy and the ferocious vicious words that were spilled about him outside the meeting room, it made them all seem very pathetic and sad.
I've heard the word spiritual refugees used to describe lesbian and gay and bisexual people who have kind of grown up cut off from their spirituality as a result of being brought up in the church and then feeling like they had to choose between the church or their coming out. And I guess I'm wondering what you would say to lesbian and gay and bi people who are spiritual refugees watching this unfold.
I would say that the church needs you, that it's often people who are at the margins of the church, or indeed of society as a whole, who bear a kernel of truth that the larger society has lost sight of. And sometimes it's people at the margins who bring back to the mainstream community something that they need to know about themselves, or in the case of the church, about God. The remarkable thing to me, and I've known gay and lesbian people throughout my ordained ministry, the remarkable thing is that so many homosexual Christians have not given up on the church, have retained their faith because they've known and experienced for themselves the acceptance and love of Jesus Christ. And they bear witness to that in the church, to people who don't know about it in the same depth. So I would say the church needs gay and lesbian people in order to remain authentic as the bearers of a truly radical and inclusive message of love to the world. And I think it's the kind of courage of the marginalized that restores health to the whole.
That's Bishop Michael Ingham of the Anglican Church of Canada, Diocese of New Westminster in Vancouver. And in Vancouver, for This Way Out, I'm Heather Kitching.
Hello, this is Todd Haynes, the writer-director of Bar from Heaven, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine.
The disturbing tale of a deeply troubled prostitute who robbed and killed seven male clients is winning high praise for its riveting narrative and outstanding acting, and has already garnered a Golden Globe Award for its lead actress. This Way Out's Steve Pride explores the movie's many layers with filmmaker Patty Jenkins and stars Charlize Theron and Christina Ricci, whose inspired performances find the humanity in the monster.
Baby did a bad, bad thing. Baby did a bad, bad thing. Baby Maybe it's a bad, bad thing.
Eileen Wuornos, one of America's first female serial killers, was executed on October 9, 2002. Who was she, and why did she kill seven men? Even though the new film Monster takes a close look at her life, according to Charlize Theron, who portrays Wuornos, there really are no easy answers.
Saying that she was crazy is one of the easiest labels, and I think we throw that so easily around to anybody who does something out of the ordinary or something horrible. We really wanted to make this movie because she had always been portrayed so one-sided as a monster. So for us to make a movie just about the sympathetic or the empathetic side of this character would have been the exact same mistake that we had a problem with in the first place, that people were doing already with her. And so the scale had to always be evened out. We never wanted to make anything underlined. We didn't want to hit people over the head with the sympathetic hammer. Feel sorry for her, feel sorry for her. I felt that within the greater truth of her life, that I really believe that there was empathy. And I had to, as an artist, walk away from this and doing all of the things that I had to do as an actor, knowing that I really believe that through all of it, through all the bad things that she had done, that her life is not as black and white as people tend to want to make it. There's a lot of gray areas in her life. And through those gray areas, you find the empathy for her. And I don't think you leave the theater. I think there are moments that you absolutely hate her, and you should. And there are moments that you can sympathize with her or understand. But it's the kind of movie where I think you leave conflicted. And I miss that in films. I miss walking out and actually going through a thought process and not just feeling one specific way about the character that I've just witnessed their life.
Charlize Theron gives a career-defining performance in Monster, so it's easy to overlook the other amazing actor in the film. Christina Ricci plays Salby, an 18-year-old who becomes the older woman's lover and inspires Wuornos' dream of making enough money to set them up in a better lifestyle.
She comes from a world that is very repressive, a world that doesn't tolerate who she is, and Eileen is a chance to actually live her life the way she wants to live her life, and that she'll do anything to maintain this freedom. And so that's where you have to wonder how much she had to do with the crimes and how much she had to do with either just being in denial, manipulating things, sort of planting the seed in Eileen that she had to keep going. She had to maintain this lifestyle. So I think that Eileen was an escape for her. Eileen was her chance, as much as Eileen kind of viewed Selby as her chance.
I am out there trying my best, okay?
Why didn't you quit hooking?
Because I needed to, all right?
Because you thought I was stupid enough to support you!
No, Selby! No,
that you wouldn't even have to me to get it, because I'm so hard up.
No, no, Selby, that is not the reason.
You said that we were going to party, 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 leave. Well, that's a bit of party!
I know, okay, Selby?
No, because it's about it. Nothing, when I tell you that I'm starving.
Because, all right, I just...
Because you're using me.
No, I...
Because you're using me!
Because I killed someone, all right?
It is a love story. And in truth, Eileen's motivations were very much like I show in the movie.
Writer-director Patty Jenkins.
The first murder was a rape situation where she was defending her life. But from there, she was really trying to have a chance, a last chance at love with this person, and had always been motivated by those things. The greatest tradition of telling these kinds of stories is to tell the real story, motivating the events, and not just recount a series of events.
Look, can I just give it to you straight? See, the truth is I'm a hooker. And I'm trying to clean my life up here, you know, go straight and Christian and all. So if there's anything that you can help me with,
So you've been convicted of a felony?
Yeah, but see, that was because I was...
That's not going to even matter, because the best you're going to get is factory work. Hey, Todd, but, do we even have any factory work?
It was such an unconditional love, and it was also... Patty Jenkins said to me the first thing, I said, what got your attention? What made you want to write this script about Eileen? And she said, there's footage, this is before I've seen anything on her. She said, there's footage on Court TV tapes of her that I saw on the news of this woman crying like a 9-year-old while her lover is testifying against her after she's just realized that she was basically being manipulated into a conversation on a telephone with her lover to confess. And that it's after realizing that betrayal, and she is breaking down, and she looks up at her lover, and she smiles and she nods in this very forgiving, understanding way. And for the 12 years that she was on death row, never once did she try to drag Selby into any of it. She never said one bad thing about Selby till the day right before she was executed. She still said, it was the love of my life. I hate that all of this had happened, because first and foremost, I think of the families whose lives I've destroyed. And I lost the love of my life. The one thing that I really wanted in my life was love, and I found it in this woman, and I lost her.
It's not what you think it is, all right?
I know what it is.
No, you don't know my life, Selby. But I know yours. And I've done everything in the whole wide world, hoping that you'd never have to know. So you could go on thinking that people are good and kind, and that it makes sense, you know? Because I love that about you, Sel. But I can't.
No, I don't want to hear this, Lee.
I know. But you need to.
We can be as different as we want to be, but you can't kill people.
Says who?
This is not the first telling of the Eileen Wuornos story. Nick Broomfield made two exhaustive, if self-involved, documentaries, one coming out just this year. And in the early 1990s, Jean Smart played Eileen in a made-for-television movie. But this is the first film in which we don't just stare at the monster. We look closely at the human being. Writer-director Patty Jenkins.
I think that the bar to try to rise to is to be able to tell a moving story that touches people without having an agenda that you're forcing upon a story. So I actually went out of my way not to make it a death penalty movie, not to make it a lesbian movie, not to make it an advocacy movie, to tell this story with as much shading and dimension as I could. From the moment that her girlfriend turned against her, I think Eileen had killed these innocent people. I think the guilt and the end of what she was pursuing was the end of her life. And those years that she sat on death row, strangely, nobody wanted to be executed more than Eileen.
This has been a conversation with Charlize Theron, Christina Ricci, and Patty Jenkins. Monster is a new Market Films release. For more information, point your internet browser to monsterfilm.com or prideonscreen.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
You ever loved someone so much you thought your little heart was gonna break in two? I didn't think so. You ever tried with all your heart and soul to get your lover back to you? I wanna hope so. You ever pray with all your heart and soul just to watch her walk away? Maybe it's a bad, bad thing. Maybe it's a bad, bad thing.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Christopher Gall, Graham Underhill, Fenceberry, Rex Walkner, Heather Kitching, and Steve Pride contributed program material. The Christ Church Cathedral Choir and Chris Isaac performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from our listeners, and we thank you. To find out how you can help this program stay on the air and get our Movies, Music, and News 2003 year-in-review programs on CD, please log on to thiswayout.org. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KHSU Arcata, California, CKUW Winnipeg, Manitoba, WREK Atlanta, Georgia, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we know you'll stay tuned.